All right, Toby, are you ready to have our last recorded conversation of the year 2016?
I am not going to... I was about to say a profanity about this year, but yes.
Yeah, that's all right.
Goodbye, 2016.
Goodbye, farewell, adieu, 2016. Good riddance.
Yeah, yeah, not coming back.
You know, there's one good thing that I can think of off the top of my head about the year 2016.
You got engaged?
Well, that was kind of happening before that a little bit. But in 2016, what I was going to say, 2016 is the year that the Office Hour podcast came to be.
You're right. That's even better than getting engaged.
Yeah, don't tell Adrian that, but you're right.
Whew, I hope she doesn't listen to
this. Oh, she definitely does not listen to this. I guarantee you that she will never hear us saying this.
So, just to ask you the first question off the top of my head, what have you been up to?
Well, I've been grading pretty much nonstop for the past week, but I can tell you what I'm going to be doing starting tomorrow. I'm going to go back to reading. Remember that? Remember reading?
Those
reading for pleasure.
Days. Yeah.
Yeah. We should have some sort of like that Wayne's World dreams. I'm Andrew Marzoni.
I'm Toby Wilson Bates.
And this is
The Office Hour.
So, reading, Toby. We both have PhDs in English literature.
Somehow.
Somehow. That is supposed to mean that we spend a lot of time reading. Do you spend a lot of time reading?
I've recently been spending a modicum of time reading. And this was my thought, that today we could talk a little bit about what we've been reading, and then possibly also what we've been watching.
Yeah, yeah, I've only really been watching Westworld, so, like, I don't know.
I'm gonna binge that this break, because I'm teaching a class on robots in the spring.
Well, there you go.
And I'm planning on showing the first episode in my first class.
It's a really good pilot. It's a really good pilot. So you have, despite your three small children, you have actually been reading books. What books have you been reading, Toby?
So, I've just concluded reading James Gleick's Time Travel, A History. And I want to talk a little bit, before I get into perhaps a little bit of critique of this, how much I like James Gleick.
Is it Gleick or Gleick?
I'm just going to say it different ways every time I say it and pretend
Gleick?
That I'm saying it the right way.
Okay.
It's G-L-E-I-C-K, so he's got a bit of everything in there.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote this book before Time Travel History called The Information, A History, A Theory, A Flood. And the scope and breadth and depth of this man's intelligence is bedazzling. In the most bedazzled way I can think of. I love this man's brain. I would happily take his brain over mine. And I love the amount of information that he packs into a pretty sizable number of pages. However, this is a book about time travel. And as a book about time travel, it falls in some ways utterly and pathetically short of actually delivering on saying something really interesting. It says, or should I say, it says tons and tons and thousands of interesting pieces of information, but then there's no point. And the New York Review of Books has a review by this guy, John Lanchester, who writes, "This perhaps is the moral of Gleick's book, all this energy and brilliance, and yet we're left feeling a little flat. The new idea, time travel, is appealing because we know time better than we used to, blah, 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 blah. All prisoners dream of freedom, perhaps never more so when they know there isn't and will never will be any possibility of escape." And so that was like his summation of basically time travel is just kind of pissing in the wind.
So what does Gleick or Gleick or Gleick or whatever get wrong about time travel?
Well, I'm going to read you like a brief little passage. This is him kind of rounding the final turn of his final chapter. "Why do we need time travel when we already travel through space so far and so fast? For history, for mystery, for nostalgia, for hope, to examine our potential and explore our memories, to counter regret for the life we lived, the only life, one dimension, beginning to end. Which sounds like an undergrad college application essay.
It does. I didn't want to be the first one to say it.
Yeah, and it's the difficulty of when historians kind of dabble in literary history, mm-hmm. I think. And it's worth saying, I think this difficulty happens whenever interdisciplinarity happens. Although I don't think it's always clear that when a historian gets into a literary idea that an interdisciplinary moment is happening, because we so often mix literature and history. But he's way out of his depth on time travel, and you get it in moments like this where he essentially does a kind of like vague generalization about why we have narrative.
Right. Why do we have narrative?
Well, I mean, you can go into a lot of different reasons or a lot of
different reasons. Yeah, I was kidding. Don't have to tell me.
That's a deep well. But I think the problem is that he essentially gets to this point and then kind of hands off the baton and is like, and time travel, woo.
Right.
Memory. And that sucks, you know? Like,
right.
Having spent a lot of time researching time travel, there's actually all kinds of interesting situational reasons why time travel is used. It's used for a number of different kind of political, historical, and cultural purposes, and in many ways is simply a very, very explicit version of the implicit existence of narrative as a kind of organizing structure for all kinds of things where it doesn't seem to have a place, like science.
I have two good time travel anecdotes. The first one is just, it's not even an anecdote, it's a recommendation. I recently read a book about time travel, which is Daniel Clowes' most recent graphic novel, Patience.
Ooh, I haven't read it.
I'll buy it for you for Christmas. It's amazing. The second thing is that a couple of years ago, I was listening to a Marc Maron interview with Paul Thomas Anderson. This is a little gauche because I'm referencing another podcast within a podcast.
Faux pas.
But in this interview with Paul Thomas Anderson, Anderson was talking about the making of the film Inherent Vice, which was the adaptation of the Thomas Pynchon novel, which is set in, you know, a sort of like fictional Southern California beach town in 1970. And what Paul Thomas Anderson was talking about was in the early stages of the film, when really all he knew was that he maybe wanted to do an adaptation of this Pynchon novel and Joaquin Phoenix was maybe going to star in it, what he decided to do is he had stockpiled all of the years all of this old film stock, like film stock from the 60s and the 70s, and it was just sitting in his garage. And so he decided to take Joaquin Phoenix down to the beach and just start shooting him on the beach with this old film stock from like the 70s.
Oh, I see.
And then he went back and watched it, and it looked exactly like the period from the film stock. And he was talking about how it was a really, like liberating creative moment, because he realized that like that is what time travel is.
Yeah.
Like he actually was able to travel through time just by using this sort of like, you know, old technology to do so.
And that's like La Jetée, which of course is Chris Marker's great time travel story. It's exactly this, where it's like photographs and it's black and white. And this idea that you like incorporate old technologies to create like the reality that existed before your reality to reflect on time travel.
And La Jetée is good sort of reference for Patience too, because Patience is in a way a kind of like update of La Jetée, as, you know, a lot of contemporary time travel stories are.
Terminator is also that.
Right.
So, what have you been reading?
Well, I have a couple of things that I have been planning on reading, one of which, they're both things I'm supposed to review, one of which is this book called Blitzed by Norman Ohler. This just came out in the UK. It's not out in the US yet. I think it's coming out in the US in May or something like that.
And it's about drug Nazis?
It is called Blitzed, Drugs in Nazi Germany. And this was getting a lot of press. Apparently, it was a huge bestseller in Germany. Norman Ohler is not actually an academic or historian. He's a creative writer. He writes novels. I think he's written for some screenplays for the likes of Wim Wenders and such. But anyway, the story behind it is that basically one of his friends from the old club days in Berlin was like, "Hey, Norm, did you know that, everyone... during the Nazi era was on drugs all the time?" And he said, "No, I didn't know that." And it turns out that there was an archive that he went to that had all sorts of documentation surrounding this rumor. And there was such a wealth of it that he decided it would be, kind of a shame to just write a novel about it, but rather he should write, the history of drugs in Nazi Germany.
This also makes a ton of sense to me. Like, I've read this piece by Susan Griffin from A Chorus of Stones called Our Secret that's all about sort of the way the Nazis constructed this system whereby nobody does anything but atrocity happens.
Absolutely.
So that you get to do, everyone along the way just signs papers, and then at the end, like, 6 million people die or whatever.
Well, and I was also interested in this by the fact that a few months ago, I learned for the first time that that Donald Trump is a teetotaler. He doesn't drink. And he also does not apparently consume caffeine either. And I thought it was very interesting because it's going back to this sort of myth of, like, the pure man. Which, Hitler was supposed to be. He was a vegetarian who, hated smoking. But apparently, according to Norman Ohler, Hitler was addicted to opiates and a number of other substances. Subsequent reviews of this book have kind of, like, bashed its historical accuracy, accused Ohler of playing a little fast and loose with the historical data. I can't weigh in on that yet because I haven't gotten more than a few pages into it because I've been grading, but, I look forward to sort of seeing how that turns out.
On a seminar, this is actually when I got into graduate school at University of California, Davis. I went and sat in on a seminar taught by Catherine Fredrickson, and she was teaching Foucault, and there were history majors who had cross-listed and were taking the class. And so after teaching all this stuff on Foucault, I think it was like the kind of forensic medical stuff, she's like, "Well, I'm not sure what Foucault's status is in history departments right now." And one of the history graduate students was like, "He's pretty much persona non grata. We think he's just like a snake oil salesman." And she said, "Okay, that's understandable." And it's also worth saying that is understandable. Like, I'm not going to pretend Foucault had like a penchant for historical accuracy. However, when you're looking at something like drug cultures or alternative sex cultures, like, it seems almost by nature you could not possibly have a clear historical trail of these cultures, right? Like, you need to go off of something like rumor and, innuendo and circumstantial evidence.
Gossip.
Because,
absolutely.
This evidence is destroyed in the time that it's being made.
I couldn't agree with you more, Toby, and that is exactly why I'm not a historian. The other thing that I'm reading a couple other things. The other is this book, Slapstick Modernism, Chaplin to Kerouac to Iggy Pop by Will Solomon. An excellent sort of literary history about the evolution of slapstick comedy through early silent film and experimental literature in the 60s and rock and roll music. I'm enjoying that quite a bit. And then the other thing that I've been reading most faithfully is Christopher Isherwood's Berlin Stories. Which are two novels, The Last of Mr. Norris and Goodbye to Berlin, the latter of which was later adapted into the film Cabaret. But I decided to read this right after the election because, like many, I saw this as sort of a a turn to autocracy and fascism, and I wanted to read a novel about the rise of fascism and see if, you know, it had any resonance with my life in the past few years. And so far, my life has proven not to have all that much in common with Christopher Isherwood's life in Berlin in the early 30s. But it's still very, very interesting, and I can't recommend this one enough. I plan on probably finishing it tomorrow.
We should do a podcast in the spring where we like read some poetry.
Ooh, that's good, because I'm gonna be teaching some poetry in the spring, so we can do. I just discovered this poet that I'm really obsessed with too. Jeffrey McDaniel. So yeah, we should read some poetry. Yeah,
maybe I'll read the Deep Sea Cables. I love that thing.
Yeah. So you wanna? So we talked about what we're reading. What are you watching? You watch anything good recently?
I watched something that surprised me very much with its goodness. So my wife got a few different movies for us to watch. One, she got the new Star Trek movie, which was bad. Which was like actively bad. Which was unfortunate. In my opinion, because I don't think any of the actors were bad. I just think the movie was bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then we watched Central Intelligence with Kevin Hart and The Rock.
Oh, that sounds great.
It was actually great. And
by the way, I think you're supposed to call him Dwayne Johnson.
I will call him whatever he wants me to call him. He's Time's Most Beautiful Man of the Year.
That's appropriate.
And so,
you know, Nick Nolte was the Most Beautiful Man of the Year once.
Get out of my house. Yeah,
and not that long ago. It was like 1995 or something like that. It's crazy.
Maybe it was sort of like a Nirvana. We like used up like dying people.
Yeah. Anyway, go on about Central Intelligence.
So I'd read a brief review of it that called it kind of juvenile and infantile and scatological and this kind of stuff. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. It looks like it could be one of those movies that they end up using, you know, kind of fat suit CGI and super lame. And then I watched it, and not only was it not that, but I thought it did a really nice job of commenting on that. There's like moments where like Kevin Hart will make a kind of racist joke about, you know, Asian penis size, and the person will be like, whoa, like, that was really racist what you said. And like, whenever there's like that moment, or like there'll be a joke, there's like I don't mean to spoil any jokes, but a joke about like The Rock watching like Molly Ringwald movies and Kevin Hart being like, no, like, we're black, we don't do that, and being kind of like, I think that was racist, I think what you just said was, or, you know, like,
right.
they actually like do the meta joke on top of the joke.
Uh-huh.
And they kind of jump you in, like, what you're thinking in that moment, which I thought was actually really good. And, you know, the kind of bromance aspect of it is really enjoyable.
Bromance is just so hot, right? Do you think that's going to go away ever?
I don't know. I mean, I think about ancient Greek culture and sort of man love and this kind of stuff that, so far as I can tell, especially so long as homosocial relationships continue to be fraught in this kind of the blurry and dangerous line between homosocial and homosexual activity, I think there will be sort of like an infinite supply of art born out of that like tension.
And podcasts, for that matter.
Oh, Andrew.
I think I want to end there, Toby, because I really want to congratulate you and I on the completion of our first successful season of our podcast.
It's been really enjoyable.
It's been really great. And I think we're going to have to keep this going in the spring, right?
Yeah, I'm all for it.
We'll do some poetry. Hopefully by then you'll have watched Westworld.
I will have definitely have
we
watched
can,
Westworld.
We could potentially just turn this into a Westworld podcast.
Let's do it.
The Office Hour is produced by Andrew Marzoni and Tobias Wilson-Bates, Britain Fellows in the Writing and Communication Program at the Georgia Institute of Technology. To find out more about the topics discussed, see our page at textile.lmc.gatech.edu. Thanks for listening!